Today, August the 25th, 2018, we can take pause to thank Father for ascending us higher in truth. Rather than recline on the mountains of doctrine that we have graciously gathered, our purpose is to receive divine luminescence so that we may descend upon the world with our vision. Today we begin series 40. The series is entitled Elected Witness. To comprehend this directive, our first study is entitled Mount Transfiguration. As an introduction, suffice it to say that God needs saints for a myriad of reasons. Let none think that there are just limited reasons why God calls people. But our calling is to articulate His goodness as witnesses. We find a launch pad for our mission in Matthew chapter 17. Let me read verses 1 through 12, 14 through 16, and verse 20. And after 6 days, how many days?
Six.
And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John his brother, and bringeth them up into an high mountain apart. What type of mountain?
High.
A high mountain apart. As you scan the geology of Palestine, never been there before, but I'm not so certain that there are any mountains that fit that qualification. And you wouldn't think that there would be a change in the topography of these past 2,000 years. But let's meditate on that as we advance. And bringeth them up into an high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them. And his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias, which we understand to represent Elijah, talking with him. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise, and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, Tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. And his disciples asked him, saying, Why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Elias truly shall first come and restore all things. But I say unto you that Elias is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. Verse 14. And when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man kneeling down to him, saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is lunatic and sore vexed, for oftentimes he falleth into the fire and oft into the water. And I brought him to thy disciples, and they could not cure him. And let us include verse 17. Then Jesus answered and said, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him hither to me. Verse 19. Then came the disciples to Jesus apart and said, Why could not we cast him out? Verse 20. Jesus said unto them, Because of your unbelief. For verily I say unto you, if ye have faith as a grain of mustard seed, ye shall say unto this mountain, Remove hence to yonder place, and it shall remove, and nothing shall be impossible unto you. Let us begin to ascertain the fullness of meaning by understanding the principle of Deuteronomy 18. It shows that a prophet like unto Moses would be raised up unto the Hebrew people, to the Jews in this case, and he was going to commune with them as a remedy for their repine and their complaints that Christ's light was too bright and his voice was too thunderous. I give you this backdrop to say that Christ, we know, based upon the prophecy of Deuteronomy 18, you can go back and read it in its particulars afterwards, promised to clandestinely rest and abide upon a prophet like unto Moses, which we know to be Jesus. And that would be the remedy for their anxieties about his self-presentation. We need that as a backdrop because the point needs to be re-emphasized at this time. It was Christ hidden within Jesus that took them along that journey, causing them to ascend into the mountain. Oh, that is no small point. It's one that needs repeated and ratified here. Because evidently, incontrovertibly, as a matter of indisputable fact, and absent nil even an iota of doubt, this ascension, this arduous climb, must represent a work of Christ. With that understanding in mind, let us read up a little bit about the meaning of this work. I take you to John chapter 10. Let's read verse 24 and 25. Then came the Jews round about him and said unto him, How long dost thou make us to doubt? If thou be the Christ, tell us plainly. The church back then could not discern whether Jesus was the Christ. And as a result, it inspired a great deal of confusion, a great deal of debate. And they wanted the Lord to tell them plainly. The Lord says, no, that's not the way it was promised to work. He says in verse 25, I told you, and ye believe not, the works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. This is why I made emphasis on the point that it's a work of Christ. I've already told you once and you didn't listen. You've got to examine the works that I do. And that's the world's first opportunity to discern my connection to the Father. If you want to know if I'm the Christ, you have to examine the works. And that's why we are occupying this study in Matthew chapter 17. But seeing that it was so difficult, even for the scholars of yesterday, I think sometimes we take for granted the advances of the gospel for over the last 2,000 years. But 2,000 years ago, we needed to be reminded that there was nobody on earth, not one person, that had more understanding of righteousness than the Jewish church. That point is worthy of emphasis because it manifests that somebody is required to bring elucidation to his works. Evidently so, because none have been able to explain, as you're going to hear it explained, the Mount of Transfiguration until this hour. Thus, amidst our Christian duties, amidst our zeal to preach the gospel, amidst our desire to come into compliance with the principles and the standards of salvation, we should have been looking for a witness to explain transfiguration. And we should have known that it would only be one man. Whatever the meaning, only one man shall know the doctrine. That's what John chapter 7 tells us. We use terms like witness. But what witness just means is delineating to the church the true doctrine. The Lord said, my doctrine is not mine, but his that sent me. If any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine, whether it be of God or whether I speak of myself. Somebody's got to do the will. I sit back and reflect on the path of the mustard seed and the sojourn that we've taken, and I find joy in the fact that we began to understand the need for communion, the need for washing each other's feet, which merely we've shown as a manifestation of opening ourselves up to each other. And invariably, some of the things that we are trying to hide, we do so because we know they're in violation of the will. I'm not going to pose the question today, but I think it's going to be as consistently answered as it was in our last seminar when I asked, how many of you have been able to completely and entirely overcome all the challenging nuances of the will of the Father? There were no yeses. There were no yeas. We're still locked in a struggle. What does that mean for the disciples? What negative or positive message can we therefrom garner? Does it mean that we can't have a salvation? Does it mean that we can't win discipleship? Does it mean that we can't have life? Remember, Father pronounced of man's plight by saying, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. But we're talking about coming into compliance. What it simply shows for us for now, and perhaps the Father will enlighten us more as we advance, is that you have not done the will of the Father. You cannot represent the doctrine. I don't want to sound boastful, but of all the principles that I've been able to garner home from the testimony of Jesus, I've been able to come into full compliance. Because I'm not doing my own will, I'm doing the will of the Father. I told you some of the excessive habits that I've had that I've been able to break. I told you that I've been able to preclude myself from yearning after other women illegally. I've told you that I've been able to show love restraints for my wayward children. You know the litany of the requisites that the Father mandated, because these were not Christ's mandates. These were mandated directly from him. And if you haven't been able to come into compliance, you simply have to recline in the fact that you haven't perfectly done the will of the Father. Therefore, when Elijah emerges, you have to suffer under his reprimand, because he knows the doctrine. I cite that to you just as an advancing sidebar to show us where we are as this study. We'll do so even more as we continue in this day and time with regard to our journey towards salvation and towards the kingdom. Another point stands tall as we examine transfiguration. This is a point that will shock some of you. It's a point that may appall some, but let it be announced far and wide that as manifest by the works of the Lord, heaven does not begrudge the concept of favoritism. We may think that it's a wrong thing to do, to show favor to one child over the other, to show favor to one employee or employer over another, to show favor to one race over another. Father does not disdain favoritism. I could take you to the lesson of Jacob and how he showed favor to Joseph. We've been there before. But the point now is to underscore that such, even though it's a matter of popular concept, the righteousness does not register in the annals of heaven as a violation of some precept of grace. How do we know? Because he chose three disciples. Who were they? Peter, James, and John. The rest of you fall back. You can't come. These are the ones that I have elected. These are the ones that I have chosen. Therefore, that choice has to be honored in heaven and in earth. Let us have a little bit of exploratory understanding here and see if we could discern on what basis were the three disciples selected. Can anybody help me out? What was the calculus? What was the basis? Well, this one, has chiseled and fine features. Come along with me. Or, well, this one I like because they're short and they'll be able to have low center of gravity as we ascend. Well, this one has brought a big lunch with them. What were the basis? This is a fundamental question. What was the predicate of their selection? It's important to know. I'm sure that Peter, James, and John, why me? Why do I got to go? I'm sure they didn't say that. But I can guarantee you the other disciples, well, why not me? Let me take you quickly to 1 Samuel chapter 16. Another selection process came, and the prophet Samuel was sent to the house of Jesse. And Samuel, not understanding this principle, thought that Eliab, he had almost a meltdown, thought that Eliab, stately, tall, handsome, elderly, the firstborn of Jesse would be the next king. The Lord said, I have rejected him. Then he gave us the principle. He said, but the Lord saith unto Samuel, look not on his countenance, or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord seeth not as man seeth. For man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. Oftentimes, we wonder why the Lord doesn't answer our prayers. And I'm sure that there are several reasons that preclude him from giving us the desires that we petition to him for. But one reason is that God knows our heart. Let me just give you a brief illustration that will bring us to our contemporary time setting. There's been a lot of political upheaval in America today over the President Donald Trump and his misgivings. He has proven to have affiliation of unseating the U.S. government as he seeks to embrace and inculcate into his empowerment the enemy of Earth's freedom. The former head of the KGB, the Soviet Union, and the president did so clandestinely and illegally. God wants freedom on the earth. He doesn't want to suffer this land of bastion of freedom to fall under the aegis of enemies of his work. The president is a man who is definitely in violation of the testimony of Jesus. What did Jesus say? Suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. Yet this is a man who wants to send the transitory children back home to the tyranny that they suffered under before. This is a man who wanted to and has successfully kidnapped, separated mother from child, causing children thrown into perplexity and distress to suffer under horrendous pain. I tell you, there's a reason why this man, Donald Trump, is on the scene. He's a harbinger of Christological corruption. Not that he's righteous, but that the Father can compare your posture towards him and allow for Elijah to make an easy judgment. But sometimes, by virtue of the fact that the advocacy of Donald Trump, and I've mentioned a few of his excesses, could be embarrassing, we hide it in our hearts. I was sorry to hear a brother give defense to Donald Trump. How are you going to ask the Lord to deliver to you the desires of your heart when you're extolling the virtues of the enemies of God? His command was, and as a Christian, you're told to, go ye therefore and teach all nations, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. If there's any suffering, they have immigration, children come, then undergo that suffering. This is an ecumenical doctrine. If you're a Jew, if you're a Muslim, if you're a Buddhist, anybody, we all can celebrate, can't we? Jesus, because he's the only prophet in the history of the world that interrupted his day, reprimanded his disciples, so that he could cuddle and dandle on his knees the little children. I don't know what they sing in the other Christian churches, but I know that in the Adventist church, one thing we got right. We learned to sing, Jesus loves the little ones like me. How do you know? Because little ones like me sat upon his knee. How are you going to sit with a cold heart and advocate for a man that's at war with the principles of your Lord? Unapologetically. I tell you, God responds and chooses his elect based upon his ability to read the things that you've concealed in your heart. We got a little bit away from transfiguration. Oftentimes, after we have a visit with one of the brethren, we become haunted by things that we try to sweep under the rug and try to ignore. They can't do that. We've got to teach the doctrine. We being Vinette and I. So it could be the reason why you're having a difficult time finding a wife is because somebody has taken your pulse. Father has a fix on your ethics. And you need to bring those things into compliance. This is why the Lord selected Peter, James, and John. Father told him, these are the men that have the heart to witness what I'm about ready to show you. Their selection has other dimensions as well. Back to a transfigured Jesus. Have you ever been so changed? Remember what it says of him. Didn't it say his face shone with the brightness of the sun? I ask again, have you ever been so changed? Another question, why didn't the Lord beforehand or afterwards manifest himself thusly? Who was the real Jesus? The Son before or after the transformation? What does transfigure mean? It's to give a new and typically exalted spiritual appearance, according to Webster. These queries lead us to our central question. What doctrine shall we derive from the concept of transfigurement? What shall be our witness? Leading up to the full answer, let us first understand the spiritual application. We know that Christian doctrine has been advanced these past 2,000 years. This is not an occasion where the Lord ascended up to a mountain on his own. That would show that same lesson that we see in John 6, where he sent his disciples to cross over and he ascended on his own up into the mountain. No, this is a case where he took his favorite disciples. The high mountain ascension prefigures the time of the Seventh-day Adventist message. The time when the Lord separated unto himself his core of disciples. Now understand, they didn't just take one step and start climbing. They broke from camp. Then they advanced towards the mountain. And then they began to ascend. But somewhere in the Seventh-day Adventist experience, we were intended to begin our ascent. The other nine disfavored disciples, though it does not mean that salvation was canceled to them, though it does not mean that father did not have a calling for them doesn't mean that they didn't have a special commission or mission. It just means that they were disfavored disciples, men who could not represent Christianity as ordained witnesses. You could talk to some of them and you'll see. Some of them represent Christianity as swine eaters. Some as rebel rousers. Some as Saturday night partiers and Sunday morning worshipers. Some of them as men of drunkenness. Oh, sure, the Lord is not in a predisposition to cast them into hell. No, He's got to work for them. But they have not distinguished themselves by the impulses of their heart to be men that could be His true witnesses. After all, Christ commanded the three disciples set apart to reveal the vision after the resurrection. Do we need to read that again? Verse 9. It says, Jesus charged them, saying, tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead. This was the charge of the three elected disciples, which goes to show you when they united again with the nine, they had a heightened theology, didn't they? They were advanced disciples of Jesus. Men who had an experience. Men who had a testimony. Men who had a doctrine that was far in advance of their brethren. He commanded the three to reveal the vision only after the resurrection. And since none have explained this transfiguration experience until now, this must be the day of that vision revelation. And only we, the mustard seed Advent, can be the visionaries. For what good can be served to relay the episode that they witnessed without explaining its meaning? I think of an experience that I had as I was a Davidian teacher. Even as I began to teach the mustard seed, we would at that time distribute our literature, not willy-nilly, but we'd ask people if they want to read it, and we would give them books, we would invite them to studies, we would share our faith with them, letting them know that we were Davidians. But what did they do? They sent creeps to creep around us, telling people not to listen to us, not to heed or to read anything that we had to say. Every time you were seen talking to somebody, even if it was one of your own brethren whom they didn't recognize was part of your movement, they would creep up on them and tell them, watch out for that brother. That forbore for a long time until probation closed for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But you have to understand that this gospel message is isolated to only a few individuals. Only they can witness the Mount Transfiguration. People at that time, there were 7 billion people, there were 8 billion people on the earth. Not everybody is born as a visionary. Some people have consigned themselves, at best, not to be shepherds who lead, but to be sheep who follow. Should they be so faithful as to receive even that stature in the special resurrection? I tell you, this concept of being a visionary is an important concept for us to understand as we begin to anticipate our mission of witnessing. Why did the Lord say that the other disciples could not cast out devils? Because of their unbelief. In fact, He lamented, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? To Him, it was suffrage. It was a burden. Don't feel as if this is an insult to Christ. Father commissioned them to tell us exactly how He felt. So these are people like the brethren who resisted our climb in the Adventist Church. These are people who lack faith. And it's amazing because they had no faith. Said, if you have faith as a grain of a mustard seed, Therefore, the Lord wanted to advance them from their stature of faith to a small amount of faith. Faith is a grain of mustard seed, and they will have power over all forces. And nothing shall be impossible unto you. You can understand now why the Lord showed favoritism. You can understand why he discriminated. Because only people that can believe can bring freedom to the world from hell. Why is that so? Because you try to cast out the devils, then they're going to argue to the Father that you've got no business doing so. Because you doubt his word, just like the devils would say, I do. How is he going to cast me out when he's on my team? That's why you need faith as the grain of mustard seed. That's why they could not cast the devils out. Oh, there's a sermon. There's a lot of sermons in the Mount of Transfiguration. One of the ones that I want to share with you is Jesus' brightened face. It says, his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. We can understand what it means that Jesus' face did shine. It didn't say Christ's face did shine, because you could not see Christ's face. They're describing the face of the Son of Mary. They're describing the face of the only begotten of the Father. Unlike ever beforehand, Jesus had a countenance about him that made it even difficult to look into his face. It's another reason why not everybody can ascend the mountain, because not everybody can look into the sun and see righteousness. And this transfiguration, therefore, is described as exactly what we read here in Matthew chapter 17. His face and his raiment was changed. What that means is that the disciples began to see and discern, not yesterday, but today, that it was Christ who rested upon Jesus, who spoke through him, and who inspired him. That's why it says his face shone as the sun. An important point that may need to have affirmation. Let me go to show you. In John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Therefore, as a matter of indisputable fact, Christ was in existence before the flesh that he clandestinely hid himself and abode upon. It says, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father. For 2,000 years, Christology has embraced Jesus, the only begotten, wrongly, thinking that he was Christ of the Old Testament, thinking he was the eternal Son, but it was Christ's presence that was hidden upon him. And it's only by ascending up the Mount of Transfiguration that you begin to behold him as being your sunrise, your sunshine. That's why he tells us, John chapter 12, he that seeth me seeth him that sent me. I am come a light into the world, that whosoever believeth on me should not abide in darkness. That Christ gives us the illustration that he's the light into the world, which means that he is representative of our sunshine, because it's the sun that enlightens the world. Am I not right on that score? Sure I am. You can't bring everybody along with you, because you know what? If the other nine came, they would be arguing with you. No, that's not Jesus. I've seen Jesus before. That's not his face. That's somebody else. Or that just proves that Jesus is God. Because look how brightly he shines. He's been concealing it from us, but now we have the evidence. Now, these are disciples that could see the vision and could master it so that they could present it to the world. These are disciples set apart and ordained to teach the world the righteousness of Christ. That He's the one that worked through Jesus. And that His works bear witness of Him. And this is why Jesus' face shone with the brightness of the sun. I think it's interesting to observe. I think it's fascinating to give careful study. The Mount of Transfiguration, I contend to you, shows you where we are on our timeline. It manifests to us, a people of faith, how close we are to our kingdom salvation and to our empowerment. We've already gone through the journey to the mountain. We've ascended the mountain. And by virtue of the fact that we've discerned the brightness of Jesus' face, that means that we've reached the mountaintop. Only a few more episodes will show that it's time for us to descend and give our vision to the world as we were commanded. You know, the Lord said, "Go ye throughout the world, teaching men to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you." Well, this is one of the commandments. Sometime after the resurrection, we were supposed to show the vision. And as I stated to you, you cannot show the vision unless you can explain it. Otherwise, there's no benefit to the vision. And then, gets even deeper. We witnessed Moses and Elijah communing with Jesus. You ready for that explanation? Let us revisit Matthew chapter 17, verse 3. "And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him." Should we just erase that last expression from the scriptures and ignore it? It's idle words? No. They were talking with the man that ascended up to the mountain. Moses and Elijah were talking with Jesus. But we know that when Jesus spoke, Christ spoke through him. Remember, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us." So we see that both Moses and Elijah are having communion with Christ by virtue of the testimony of Jesus. The words that Christ was given to re-articulate to the world. "And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then answered Peter." Oh, talk about the timeline. Wonder how close we are to salvation? This next text is going to show us. Maybe I should let you read it on your own, and then you could come back next week or the week after and let me know what you've uncovered. Or maybe I should show you the doctrine, right? "Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here." Well, I know it's good for you to be here, Peter. That's why I called you. "If thou wilt," already he's learning to submit himself to the Father's will. "If thou wilt, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, hear ye him." Something strange, therefore. The voice that claimed Christ as his beloved Son admonished the disciples to hear him. Now, we tried to discern who that voice is. It could not have been the Father's voice, because the Father, you never heard his voice. Why would Father articulate his voice when he has Christ to speak for him, right? The message is to hear him, to hear Christ. Peter received a resounding no. That answer shows you one of the final transitions that we see in the Mount of Transfiguration. But before we uncover that point of doctrine, let us decipher Monument 1. It's the first angel's message. That represents Moses. You can't understand the first angel's message unless you are in communion with Christ. So, no monument to Moses. Monument 2, the gospel to the Gentiles, which is Jesus' message. No monument. Monument 3, Elijah's call. No, Peter, you do not understand the vision. To memorialize these three is to subvert your need for ascension. You must heed Father's will. You must hear Christ. You must embrace the combination of the three. You get it? Perhaps you don't. Our monument is not to Elijah, is not to Moses. Our monument is not to Jesus. Our monument is to memorialize, to remind the world of the words that the Father spoke through Christ, which encompasses the message of Elijah and Moses. That's why you see the three talking amongst each other. It shows a harmony in their commission, in their communion. Just to give you a short reminder, the Lord says in John chapter 6, verse 39, "And this is the Father's will which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day." The testimony of Jesus. It's going to be resurgent. It's going to be raised up again in the last day. That's the Father's will. That's why he commissioned Peter to hear Christ. "And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day." Everyone that seeth whom? The Son. It's making reference to the Son of Man. Everyone that seeth him and receiveth his testimony is going to receive everlasting life, and it's going to be a communion that's raised up at the last day. Moses' testimony is inculcated in the testimony of Jesus. You can't understand Moses unless you understand the testimony of Jesus. This is why we could go to some of the parables. We're told you the pearl of great price. Sell all that ye have and purchase the plot. This is why we're told, the rich young ruler told, sell all that you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me. You can't understand Moses' work until it's made relevant to you by the testimony of Jesus. This is why, for illustration, none have beforehand understood the need for heart circumcision. The world doesn't understand the need for the Sabbath worship. There's a myriad of other issues which the mustard seed is going to unfold that come from Moses, integrated in the testimony of Jesus because they make reference to Christ. It says, "For had ye believed Moses, ye would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if ye believe not his writings, how shall ye believe my words?" But yet and still, his words were communicated to us proverbially. Therefore, Elijah must come along to make plain his words, to give expression to what Jesus' works were, to what Jesus' words taught us, and to what Moses' contributions prevail upon us. And then when you understand that, you have the three united and conjoined as one. And this is why it's so important what E.G. White says in 7 Bible Commentary, page 985, "The three angels' messages are to be combined, giving their threefold light to the world. Therefore, all these years as Adventists, we focused and emphasized the three angels' message. But our focus should have been the three angels' messages combined. And when Peter learned that lesson, then they had the fruition of the vision to convey to the world. When Peter learned what we have learned in our last series, that the third angel combines all three, the works of Moses, the works of Jesus, and the works of Elijah, that we're not to memorialize them individually, but we are to embrace them as unfurled to us through the testimony of Jesus, then we've been to the mountaintop. We've seen the vision. We've learned the necessity of combining the three. And we've learned that when you combine the three, you hear the beloved Son. Some may ask, why not memorialize the mustard seed? I thought you were the great Derek West. I thought you were Elijah. You see, you got me all twisted, homie. If you excuse the colloquialism. That's what they say in the streets. Well, they used to say that in the streets. I don't know what they're saying now. But nonetheless, you've got me twisted. My only fame, my grandeur, is that I see the brightened face of Jesus. Jesus transfigured. And I have heard the voice of God from the bright cloud. In other words, I know that Christ speaks for the Father. What makes you so sure that Elijah represents the third angel? Revisiting the text. Matthew chapter 17, verse 10. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come? Then Jesus answered and said unto them, Elijah truly shall first come and restore all and restore all things. You're not ready to evangelize. You're not ready to take the gospel to the world. You can't bring any relief to human suffering unless you could restore all things. People need health restitution. People need financial remunerations. People need land restitution. I'm talking about my land was stolen. Well, you need Elijah. He restores all things. That land Moses shows you when he spoke of Christ, making reference to Deuteronomy 32, was distributed to the nations according to the number of the children of Israel. But more than all that, you need the restoration of justice. You need the restoration of life. How are you going to restore all things when the world, these 6,000 years, has many of its citizens slain and lying in the grave? Elijah has to call them forth. He has to be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. To this end, John chapter 5, verse 24 tells you, quote, verily, verily, I say unto you, he that heareth my word and believeth on him that sent me hath everlasting life. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself, and hath given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Close quote. Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. But we want to make sure that we understand that Elijah represents the mustard seed. It tells you, Elijah truly shall first come, but I say unto you that Elijah is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man Likewise shall also, likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. He's referring to Elijah as the Son of Man. He's telling you that he's going to come. So he's not making reference to himself. The disciples asked, is it true that Elijah must truly come first? Yes, Elijah, he says, shall first come. You don't need to correct the Father's grammar. He knows how to use present tense, future tense, and past tense. He's telling you there's a day in the future that's not today. So he's not making reference to me. He's making reference to somebody else because Elijah shall come. The Lord said, essentially, let me give you an illustration. A type of Elijah, John the Baptist, came and they did unto him whatsoever they listed. So also shall the Son of Man suffer of them. Which points us back to John chapter 6, verse 40. This Son of Man, therefore, is referring to the one that enlightens us, whom the Lord promised to raise up again in the last day. Verse 40 of John 6. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Everlasting life doesn't come until the last day, and it comes by seeing the Son and believing on him. How are you going to see the Son when he's locked up on the Mount of Transfiguration? He's got to descend so that you could see the brightness of his calling. But this Son makes clear reference to the one that's going to restore all things. It's evident by the fact that Christ says he's not going to lose anything, but he's going to raise it up again at the last day, which means that he lost things. But it's only temporary because, as it says, and this is the will of the Father which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. The fact that it has to be raised up again, and it's done through the personage of the Son of Man, shows you that the Son of Man, in harmony with what we read in Matthew chapter 17, is Elijah. For Elijah, he says, shall first come. And it shows you that Christ has to recover what he lost. Which means that Elijah has to be the one that restores all things. We have the mountaintop experience. My perspective tells me that that mountaintop is prefigurative of Mount Sinai, the place where the law was declared. Because that's the place where it's called what? It's referred to as the dwelling place of God. It just so happens that Mount Sinai is like 401 kilometers from Jerusalem. Which, according to my math, you could do the math and do double check, is how many miles? It's like 268 miles. So the journey to the mountaintop, though the Bible doesn't reveal all it in all its intricacies, had to have been a lengthy journey before they went to the ascension. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 7 and 9. And the angel of the Lord, that's the Holy Spirit, and the angel of the Lord came the second time and touched him and said to Elijah, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he arose and did eat and drink, and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Oreb, the Mount of God. Verse 9, and he came thither unto a cave and lodged there, and behold, the word of the Lord, it's not the Holy Spirit, that's Christ, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said unto him, what doest thou here? Refers to Oreb as the Mount of God. It's the same mountain that Moses ascended when he was given the law, remember? And now you have Elijah making the same communion with Christ to his mount. It may seem fanciful. Perhaps the Lord will enlighten us more on this as we advance. But think of it this way. I know you're wondering, well, the Lord was in Palestine. Why not ascend them up to one of the high and lofty mountains that were contained therein? But the Bible only says that the Lord took the three up into a high mountain. Why do we want to limit that journey to the territorial region around Jerusalem or within Palestine? There's no need to do so. If the Lord can call Moses down from where he is, and Elijah from where he is, then why could he not allow for the disciples to make a similar journey? If you're going to commune with the Lord, you might as well do so in the place he identified as the Mount of God. It is the place where both Moses and Elijah caucused beforehand with Christ. Thankfully, now we have a timeline. We can rejoice and be exceedingly glad. We have a struggle to overcome the nuances of our lives so that we can come into compliance with the will of the Father. We have ascended to the mountaintop. We have seen the vision of Jesus transfigured. We heard the voice of God as conveyed to us through Christ. We have combined the three angels' messages. Now it's time for us to comply with the commission and to begin to teach it to the world. That's why we call this series Elected Witness. We are made elected witnesses through our experience on Mount Transfiguration. And with that, I bring the study to a close.